have just one little leftover from last week. When we talk about the question of black, white, or gray, and the problem of the gray area, we are probably, most of us, familiar with the modern trend that situation ethics has taken, in which the main point is that as long as you do the loving thing, it's right. And you can even do wrong if you do it for a loving reason. Isn't that the extent to which situation ethics goes? So like the man who steals bread in Philadelphia to feed his family, this is all right because he's not doing it for bad reasons. He's doing it for good reasons. And this makes it right if it's done for a loving reason. I would like to remind you that this, on the basis of God's word, is wrong. And that it has always been wrong to steal, and always will be wrong to steal, regardless of the motive. Would you agree with that or not? Or is that a nitpicking, old legalistic approach? I don't believe it is. I believe it's always been wrong, it is wrong tonight, and always will be wrong to break any one of God's commandments, regardless of the reason and the motive. I got into a discussion with a man by the name of Widmer on that recently, up at Wawona. Have you heard of him? Flee the captor, etc. And he told me that after his experience in Europe during the war, as he looks back on it, that there are some things he would do differently after second thought. It was a very interesting discussion because some people have thought that if you are in a tight place, it would be all right to lie if it's for the purpose of saving God's people. True or false? Or is God big enough to save his own people? And if God chooses not to save his people, is that all right too? It gets kind of heavy in some people's thinking. But may we balance it with this, that when you say, I'm going to do the loving thing, this has to include the loving thing toward God as well. And the situation ethics of today simply leaves it on the basis of the loving thing toward another person. But it has to include the loving thing in terms of God who loves me, doesn't it? And that's the part that's conspicuously left out in the modern situation ethics. So you have the three Hebrew worthies on the plains of Dura. And of course, Nebuchadnezzar is their friend. And it would be very appealing to do the loving thing toward poor Nebuchadnezzar, who is fighting for his life, you know. He's afraid that another kingdom is going to follow his. And so he has the party on the plains and the image and all the rest of it. And they are his friends. He's been nice to them. So let's do the loving thing. No, because these three Hebrew worthies believed in doing the loving thing as far as God was concerned as well. So much for that. Many feedback on that before we go into the topic I've chosen for tonight. Either you're interested in the topic chosen for tonight or some other reason. Are you all exhausted? One topic we haven't talked about among the beliefs of Seventh-day Adventists in our Jesus Revealed series is the signs of Christ's coming. Now, this is one of the heaviest and the biggest and the ones for which Adventists are known. We start our public evangelistic series with them. We love these topics. Matthew 24 is on the top of the list in our Bible doctrines classes. The signs of Christ's coming, right? And we usually rattle them off, you know, sun, moon, stars, fear, men's hearts trembling, all the rest of it. I'd like to take a tack this evening that has always appealed to me since I was a little fellow. It starts like this. On November 28, 1895, there was the first automobile race in this country. The race covered a track of 53 and one-third miles, and of the 60 automobiles in the race, two made it. All the rest of them had broken axles and thrown rods and pistons, you know. And the one that came across the finish line of the two and set the world's record set it at a breaknecking speed of 5 1/4 miles per hour. That was how long ago? About 80 years, right? Pretty much 80 years. 80 years, there are people living 80 years, regardless of how you cut the generation these days. Now, the thing that has always really intrigued my imagination is that the modern inventions that began in the middle of the last century and came into this century created as much change in the world in terms of travel, communication, everything you can think of, as much change as there had ever been, and far more after nearly 6,000 years. And let's not get into a discussion on the 6,000 years tonight. Why was it that people went along for thousands of years plowing with crooked sticks, borrowing fire from the neighbor, or rubbing sticks together for that purpose? Why is it that the world went on pretty much the same as far as invention and progress like we know today? Why? Have you ever stopped to think about it? It's an amazing thought. If my grandfather, who died when my father was 9 years old, and whom I've only heard about and have a picture of in my desk, was to come out of the grave today, he'd think something had gone either terribly right or terribly wrong. I mean, spooks or something, right? Because I can remember my father telling of riding along from town with his father in the horse carriage. And his father said, "Wait a minute." He said, "I see a puff of smoke coming down the road. I think it might be one of those automobiles." And so he got the horses and the carriage and went off the side road way back and waited. And pretty soon, my dad said, horseless carriage came puffing along, dust and the horses tense, right? Why? I think that over and above the usual list that we make, there is this fantastic evidence that the only reason that things speeded up in the last 80 to 100 years was because God allowed it, God permitted it, God had something to do with it. Was it just because people all of a sudden got smarter 80 to 100 years ago? Why, the average man walking on the streets of Greece in the days of Christ had the IQ of a university professor today. Of the Greek philosophers were no children. The study of science and astronomy and all of these things wasn't new. But what about all of this multiplication of invention and speed? Why was it that one day a young fellow by the name of Stevenson sat by a steaming tea kettle? People had watched steaming tea kettles for years. They'd seen the lid bob up and down for hundreds of years, right? And all of a sudden to Stevenson, something says, there's power there. Get busy. And so Stevenson got busy. And before long, he had a crude steam engine and going on wheels down a track. Why was it that two boys working in a bicycle shop, you know, look out the window and they see the birds? Well, people had looked out windows and seen birds for a long time, hadn't they? One of them says, hey, Orv, if they can do it, why can't we? And so it wasn't long before the first flight took place, at least of those proportions. And it was less than the length of a 747 today. Big deal. The total flight was less than the length of a 747. Why didn't it stop there? Smarter people? No. We come down to the time of the end, and God looks down to this world, and he, in essence, says, speed up. God must have had something to do with it, didn't he? But for what reason? For what reason? And was it something that was predicted? Now, of course, Daniel, the 12th chapter, verse 4, has a meaning that contextually is referring to knowledge of the books of Daniel and Revelation, for instance, being increased. But for a long time, Seventh-day Adventists have at least included a double application there. Shut up the words and seal the book, even till the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. Was it predicted? What about Nahum? Nahum, the second chapter. You know, Seventh-day Adventists have seen at least a double application there, too, as though Nahum was downtown New York City, near Times Square somewhere, a view of the time of the end. The chariots shall be with flaming torches in the day of his preparation. What an interesting way to say it. The chariot, he didn't know what else to call him, did he? If this was a glimpse, a view of the very end time. The fir tree shall be terribly shaken. The chariots shall rage in the streets. They shall jostle one against another in the broad ways. They shall seem like torches. They shall run like the lightnings. Possibility of a prediction of the time at the very end. Have you ever seen chariots jostling in the streets? Have you ever gotten jostled? And have you ever run like the lightning? Or seen them run like the lightning? Up and down Howell Mountain. Back to that again. All right. What's the reason? Well, I'd like to suggest that there is one primary reason for all of it. And that is that God intended, when there was a prediction made concerning three angels flying in the midst of heaven with a message, he intended that those symbols would mean exactly what they seem to indicate. Now, of course, he's not talking about literal angels, but each of these angels represent a great movement, don't they? Revelation 14. And when John the Revelator saw these angels flying in the midst of heaven, he didn't see an old sailboat waiting in the harbor with limp sails waiting for the wind to blow so it could be off to the far-flung mission field with the gospel. John didn't see a prairie schooner stuck in the sands of Nevada somewhere with one wheel off and a sign on the side of the prairie schooner, "Everlasting Gospel," going to all the world. That isn't exactly what he saw. He saw speed. And that God wanted to have provision made, at least provision made in terms of invention and progress, so that a world that is exploding population-wise would at least have the mechanics for news to travel to all the world. Does this make sense? Now, this takes a little different tack than sometimes we've taken, because there are some of us who have sounded pessimistic on this subject, as though the population explosion has been so much and the progress of the gospel so little that, humanly speaking, it's never going to get done. And we still believe that, humanly speaking, it'll never get done. We haven't done that good. But is it possible that God has all of the pins set up, all of the media in motion, due to increase of invention, progress, so that it can happen overnight, anytime he chooses? Like the three Hebrew worthies, you see, my uncle used to say that all God needed was those three faithful young men, and the entire then known civilized world found out about the God of these three men overnight. And all he needs is a few Shadrachs, Meshachs, and Abednegoes, and perhaps the media by which the word travels. And along with that, the assurance that God has a thousand ways of which we know nothing. I don't believe that the world is going to go on forever, in spite of the dismal job that we have done. I believe that God has it set up so that this whole thing can close overnight. Do you? And maybe some of this that we've seen in the last 8 or 100 years is part of the setting up of that event. You know, Walt Whitman, according to the record, traveled from Washington to Boston in 6 months. And he traveled from Boston back to Washington in 6 months. Today you can eat breakfast in Boston, eat the same breakfast in San Francisco. Well, not the same exactly. And be preaching to the heathen by the next morning. Right? Why? It is possible to get in the right plane and leave at the right time. And watch the sunset in the east. Right? I have heard people say who do a lot of air travel that this is the most fantastic invention that has ever been. And you have to admit, it's rather fantastic. I was standing in the airport in San Francisco watching Emilio Knechtle leave, a doctor friend of mine, and I had taken him to the airport after he visited us in Mountain View several years ago. It was the first time we had seen one of these 747s. And as that thing, a giant thing, taxied down the runway to take off, my friend, I heard him mumbling something under his breath, and I listened, and what he was saying was, "It's got to be of the devil." Mesmerism. or something. How can you explain it? Only that God permitted it. Matthew 24:14, this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Now, the second question is this. If God permitted this sort of thing at the very end, why didn't he permit it or cause it sooner? And it seems to me that that's a heavy question, too. Any clues? Why did God allow them to go on for hundreds of years doing the same thing the same old way? I think that without even looking for authority, we can look around us and logic and reason give us the answer. It's what we have done with what we have that has brought us to a tremendous crisis in the world, right? And it's obvious that the reason that God did not permit it sooner is that man would have blown himself to bits if God had permitted it sooner. And this is quite obvious. Of course, great men, scientists, great brains have realized this. And when they come out and say that the Seventh-day Adventist is the calamity howler of today, they have missed the point, because it's the Seventh-day Adventist that's taking the back seat on the calamity howling. It's the scientist and the statesman who's the calamity howler today, the ones who have their eyes open, like Wernher von Braun and all the rest of them. And like Albert Einstein, who is no mean man, comes to this country and they meet him at the airport and they say to Mrs. Einstein, "Do you understand Einstein's theory?" She says, "I don't even understand Einstein." And they say to Einstein, "What kind of weapons are we going to use in World War III? And he says, "I don't know, but I'd tell you what kind we're going to use in World War IV. And they said, "What kind?" He said, "Rocks." And that's not too far off, you know. Doesn't take much to get that message. If God had permitted this whole thing sooner, we would have blown ourselves to bits long before now. So there's some kind of a timing and a clock. In 1918, after World War I, one of the lords stood up in the Parliament in London and quoted Shelley's lines, "The world's great age begins anew, the golden years return." And no one's been quoting Shelley since, with World War II and all of the other conflict and police actions and summit agreements and disagreements. In fact, just in the news this last week, the communists in China are saying that World War III is inevitable. And are preparing. Well, that's nothing new. We've all been. And so, evidently, God has some sort of a timetable in which he knows that sin will have demonstrated itself to its full by a certain time and condition. And along with that timetable, he brings on modern invention, scientific knowledge, that will enable the final gospel to the last generation. And all of it reaches toward a certain pivot point, right? And And before man, with all of his technology, comes to the place where he blows himself to bits, the rest of what God intended by the increase of knowledge takes place, evidently. And God finishes the whole plan because of Revelation 11, verse 18. The nations were angry. Thy wrath is come, the time of the dead that they should be judged, and that thou shouldst give reward unto thy servants the prophets, and to the saints, and them that fear thy name, small and great, and shouldst destroy them which destroy the earth. Now, of course, another meaning here is destroy those who corrupt the earth. And the corruption involves more than just destruction. Corruption leads to destruction. And so that reminds you of the kind of corruption that man has introduced with the modern invention. Because it's obvious, isn't it, that much of the modern invention and scientific increase has resulted in the degeneration and decay and downward sweep. And it all still points toward a common pivot point where God, as someone said, calls 30 for tonight. So I just wanted to share with you this aspect of it that has always intrigued me. When Sir Isaac Newton made the prediction in his day that the day would come when men would travel at the fantastic speed of 60 miles an hour, and Voltaire said, you see what religion has done to Sir Isaac Newton? It has made a silly dotard out of him. Voltaire said, anyone knows that it would be physically impossible for man to travel at 60 miles per hour. And then they both died. And if they were to come forth from their graves today, what a surprise they'd have. Of course, Voltaire would still want to ride his old gray mare. And Newton himself would be surprised. But God's word and his message still goes on, and we still have the promise that God will finish what he started. Okay, any thoughts concerning your rehearsal, your reminder, your exposure to the well-known Adventist emphasis on the signs of Christ's coming? Anyone have anything they'd like to add to this particular topic tonight? Before we close. Over here, yes. She just ruined my entire topic for the evening. It was a good thing I didn't belabor the point any longer. She says that we were told as far back as 1888 that Christ could have come before that time. He didn't need any of this. Okay. I surrender. I'm leaving town. Anyone else, or does that pretty well sew it all up? Yes, back here. When the nations have filled up their cup of iniquity, it's not going to go any longer. All right? Yes. The wickedness of the world increases in proportion to the manifestation of Christ's character. And the world in the days of Christ couldn't stand more than 3 years of him. So it could be that the manifestation of Christ's character and the manifestation of Satan's character will... What was the last part of that? Both manifested fully, then the end will come. All right, thank you. Yes. Yes, that this is going to ultimately be turned around and Christians will be held accountable for the world getting worse and worse because of the character of God manifested Yeah. You even see that in a home where you have a godly person and an ungodly one. The ungodly one is ungodly because of the godly person, and often says so, right? Yes. You're asking? They what? They had a witness for years. He says this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world. India is closing up. Other Oriental countries closed up. How can you harmonize that? You know, sometimes we've had the impression that everyone is supposed to become Christian, or everyone's supposed to become Seventh-day Adventist before Christ could come. And this evangelist Hoffman, what is his name? J. Reynolds Hoffman. He makes quite a point out of the fact that we err on that. That it is simply that people have had an opportunity to hear of the gospel. That's all. Have they had opportunity to hear? But of course, that haunts you when you ask in a country like Japan, where you have lots of modern scientific knowledge at work, less than 0.5%. How many people really have had opportunity to make a decision about Jesus? They say not very many. That's why God has to use one of his thousand ways, of which we know nothing. She says, what are these nations closing up to? Would it be a bit of spiritual pride to think that they're just closing up to you and me, and therefore they have no more chance? Yeah, precisely. When I read Watchman Nee in China and see some of the insights into spiritual things that he had without some of the advantages that I have, and the way that his pen goes on, I'm amazed that, you know, God has other means than you or I here. Yes. How miserable it must be for the non-Christian to look at his world and see it crumble. And what a privilege for the Christian to look at the same thing and see what's coming. Hope. That's good. Thank you. I like that. Over here? Yes. The last revelation to a dying world is the manifestation of the character of Christ. Is this the witness? Well, that the second coming of Christ, in terms of his timing, may even be a surprise to some of the elect.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you would discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. American Christian Ministries is not a one-man band. It is an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.